Okay, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Christina Planick from USAID's Bureau for Economic Growth, Education, and Environment. And I work on the market systems portfolio, which of course intersects deeply with the resilience portfolio, and that makes for quite an interesting combination. In this discussion now, we're going to explore resilience and sustainable poverty escapes. There's been quite a bit of interesting research done on this topic, which we will discuss here in a moment. Let me briefly introduce our panelists. You can see their full bios in your agenda. But Andrew Shepherd, here in the center, is the director of the Chronic Poverty Advisory Network, CPAN, and a principal research fellow at the Overseas Development Institute, or ODI, in London. Andrew and his team have researched poverty dynamics in several countries, including specifically with USAID partnership in Ethiopia, Bangladesh, and Uganda. And they're now extending that research into other countries, so hopefully he'll tell us a bit about that. Anna Garlock, here at the end of the table, is the director in the Inclusive Market Systems team within the Technical Learning and Application Division at ACDI Boca. Previously, she was the chief of party for the Leveraging Economic Opportunities, or LEO, activity, where she oversaw LEO's collaboration with USAID Center for Resilience and ODI on sustainable poverty escapes research, and co-authored a programming and policy implications brief associated with that. And Dr. Saeed Hashemi is headed a multi-country program for CGAP to develop new pathways to graduate out of extreme poverty and food insecurity through integrating social protection, livelihood activities, and financial services. He continues to be a senior advisor for them for their graduation program. Okay, so let me do just a bit of framing for this session. Resilience has been most commonly applied to contexts or populations subject to recurrent crises as a means of reducing future humanitarian liabilities. We heard a lot about this morning. And more recent evidence on poverty dynamics underscores the broader utility of resilience for ensuring people not only escape poverty, but remain out of poverty in the face of shocks and stresses. So it's not necessarily just resilience for the extreme poor. We want resilience for everyone. But this leaves us with two important questions, ultimately. The first, to what extent are households sustainably escaping poverty? And why do some households escape poverty only to fall back into it, while others, the more resilient households, are able to sustainably escape? So in 2016, under the USAID LEO project, ODI looked at these questions more closely in Bangladesh, Ethiopia, and Uganda. The body of work is quite broad and includes the individual country cases, a synthesis of the three, a methods note for those who would like to replicate the research in other places, a program and policy implications brief, and findings from applying a multidimensional poverty lens in addition to the original more monetary consumption lens. So I encourage you to dig deeper into that broader portfolio of work. It can all be found at microlinks.org/LEO poverty dynamics. So if you go to that page, you will find all of the products. And then we're going to be pairing this research up with other work like CGAP's graduation study. And we start to see how critical poverty dynamics are for sustaining development progress. So we'll introduce this by taking a quick look at the overall findings from the LEO ODI research. And I think this is kind of the summary graph of those slides here. So if you take a look at this from the three country case studies, what we've got here is that we see the transitory escapes where households escaped poverty and then fell back into it over the three or four waves of data that were looked at, depending on the country. In Bangladesh, 10% of the households had a transitory escape. In Ethiopia, it was 15%, and in Uganda, it was 9%. You can also notice the churn category, which is the yellow bit, where you've got the households that kind of cycle around the poverty line. So they're a little bit out, a little bit back in, and just kind of keep that movement. This idea of churn was also raised in the recent post-conflict livelihoods research that was put out by the Secure Livelihoods Research Consortium, They only utilized two waves of panel data, but noted that in their two waves, that all of the households, when divided into quintiles, moved from the first wave to the second. Some for the better and some for the worse. So this idea of the movement of households around the poverty line is coming up in multiple research streams. Also important to note that's not here in this particular infographic is the household that became impoverished over the period. So this is really looking at the ones that were attempting the escape, and some of them succeeded, which is the blue part. But there are also households that started out fine and then over the period of time fell into poverty, and that's not even captured here. So the numbers are fairly significant. And ultimately, if we can't lessen the rate of transitory escapes, we're failing these households and wasting a portion of our investment. So this is important. What is driving this? For many families in the cases, it was a series of shocks in quick succession. Most could cope with a single shock, but the layering effect was more powerful than their coping resources. And when families were already strained by systemic stressors, something like land degradation, for example, it made coping with the shocks even more difficult. Now, obviously, there is nuance to the findings in each country case that are well worth exploring, but there are some generalizations that also came through. Surprisingly, female-headed households were more likely to sustain an escape, perhaps because they were also more likely to receive remittances. No surprise here, but owning productive resources like land and livestock was a source of resilience. Smaller households and those whose head was educated fared better, and engagement in non-farm activities was a benefit to the household, back to the risk diversification of livelihood. So now we'll hear a bit from each of our panelists in turn, and then we'll have a couple questions that I will present to them, and then hopefully we'll have some time to take some questions from you as well. Andrew, you're up first.
Okay. It's my voice, so I hope you can hear me. Is it okay?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Well, I'm going to talk about Ethiopia because I've only got 5 minutes, is that right? Or something like that. And I thought to try and talk about three wouldn't be possible. And you asked me to mention which other countries we're going on to work on. And there's a little list here. Rwanda, we've already done some work on under a different heading. Niger, Malawi, Kenya, Philippines, Nepal, Tanzania, the other countries that we're working on in this sort of way. I don't know, did you say, Kristen, that we try and, as well as analyze the panel data, that is surveys which track households at different points in time, go back to the same households, and that's what produces those kind of figures. We also do qualitative work around it, and I think a lot of the insights that we can get from this research come from the qualitative research, the qualitative side of it. So we always try to maximize that. One of the big things now is that there are some of these panel data sets tracking the same households that have gone over 3 points in time. And this is why we're able to talk about people sustaining their escapes from poverty. And the picture is, as Kristen said, very different in different countries. So in Ethiopia, you got some slides, that's great. Oh, I don't know if you can see that. I'm sorry, there's a couple of life histories encapsulated in a diagram. You can't really see what the details are. And I'm not going to talk through those, but I was just going to have it there as background. I'll talk through another slide in a bit more detail in a moment. What we found, we've done two studies in Ethiopia, which is why I picked it as a country, although I know Ethiopia less well than Uganda and Bangladesh. But we did a study in 2016 with USAID, and we're now doing another study using a newer national data set, again, three-wave panel. And I'm going to report a little bit on that. I mean, it's work in progress. It's not been published yet, but the earlier one has been published. The earlier one was by my colleagues Chiara Mariotti and Vidya Duwaka. they found high levels of impoverishment. You mentioned impoverishment, so going into poverty for the first time, and high levels of transitory escapes from poverty, and quite low levels of sustained escape in Ethiopia. And a similar pattern has been found in the later research that we've done. So the overall pattern of mobility seems to be similar. And the kind of factors that they began to pull out in creating a story around the survey data and the qualitative research were things like, at the macro level, the relatively slow pace of economic transformation in Ethiopia in terms of shifting from agriculture to other sectors, in terms of urbanization, in terms of demographic change. Linked to that, the very limited, although the study was done last year, the quantitative data referred to period up to 2009. So, and there's some significant differences between the old data up to 2009 and the new data, which I'll tell you about in a moment. So very limited rural non-farm economy, and very limited migration at that time. Some transformation going on, but quite a lot of regions and individuals and households left out of that. Another big macro factor was inflation, especially food price inflation, and this was pushing a lot of people into poverty or making it very difficult to stay out of poverty. And the background in not all areas in Ethiopia, but in some areas, was of high land pressure and climate change-induced pressures on land degradation and so on. And also in many areas, again, it's quite varied across Ethiopia, but in many areas, still quite high fertility, so high reproductive rates. We all know the story about repeated exposure to droughts. This came out, but certain specific effects of that to be noted were the reduced schooling which kids ended up as a result of some of these repeated droughts. Very hard for parents to keep kids in school. And of course, education is well known as something which helps. The more education you have, well known to help people out of poverty and to sustain those escapes. The transfers, the PSMP, which was operating at that time, had a significant impact in terms of consumption, but it wasn't then enabling asset building or savings, as far as we could see. This will come on to these issues more with Hashimi's presentation. Interestingly, land ownership was not particularly associated with sustaining an escape from poverty, except for female-headed households. Now that's quite an interesting one, given what you said earlier about female-headed households. But livestock ownership was very highly associated with sustaining escapes from poverty, and in particular the ability to sustain the escape that you made, partly using your livestock, your farming, whatever other resources you brought together, was the ability to sell livestock when the going gets rough. And I think there's, in some areas of Ethiopia, there's a particularly lively market in the sale of heifers. So that seemed to be something. So, for example, social expenditures are incredibly important across rural Ethiopia. People have to have something to sell in order to be able to participate in social ceremonies, and that's really important to keeping your status up, your social capital and so on, and obviously in droughts as well if you have livestock to sell. So the land ownership issue was also interesting because we looked at having access to inputs, and that really did make a difference. And in both pieces of qualitative work we've done, it's not reflected so much in the quantitative work, irrigation comes up as a particularly important asset, or access to irrigation is very important. And inputs, fertilizer, seeds and so on, price changes in those can also apparently be impoverishing. So it's not just the availability, but it's also the price. And that's something that, I think governments often like to subsidize and so on, and maybe there are some, or they like to stabilize these prices. Maybe there's some good reasons for that. Now I'll come on to the later research, and I won't go through the same set of factors that has come out of the later research, but just point out some of the differences. So this later research data was between 2011-12 and 2015-16, three waves again, two droughts reflected during that period. This was the period of the government's growth transformation strategy, focusing on achieving rapid growth, which they did. Smallholder agricultural productivity, labour-intensive manufacturing industry, and urban development and infrastructure and jobs for the urban poor. So it was a bit of a refreshed new strategy at this time. If you look at the figures on the screen, I've just highlighted a couple of them for you. The sustained escapes from poverty, P and N, so poor, non-poor, non-poor, the three waves, you can see a very small proportion. Majority of the respondents are chronically poor. And then there's quite a lot of movement around the poverty line. And the PNP, this is the transitory escapes, also a relatively small group, actually, by comparison. The majority of escapes from poverty don't take people very far from the poverty line. And I think this is something worth stressing. If you look at the average income, the mean and the median average incomes in both are given on the right-hand side, they're pretty close to the kind of lower levels among those groups, so the PNP group and the PPP, chronically poor group, not so far from the average income. The urban households, and again, female-headed households. I mean, this thing about female-headed households, I think, is really something that needs to be looked at. But in the previous work, we thought that perhaps, this was from the qualitative research, we thought that perhaps female-headed households were doing better staying out of poverty if they were receiving remittances. So that may be one factor. Quite often they're being targeted by one program or another. There's a lot of targeting in Ethiopia, so that may be another factor. I think this is something that needs a bit more, we need to do a bit more research on this. In the new research, migration, comes out very strongly, particularly local migration. Migration overseas, definitely, which has increased tremendously between these two periods of research, but also local migration, which indicates that, you know, the economy is diversifying, there is an urbanization process going on, people are taking up these opportunities. Employment comes out very strongly. Non-farm activities comes out pretty strongly, especially in terms of improving people's consumption levels, so reducing income poverty, not so much in terms of actually getting people out of poverty, the sort of big movements that we try to monitor, but it certainly comes out in terms of improving consumption. And the other factors are common, livestock, demographic change, education, but in the quantitative research, getting new occupations, you know, being able to move away from agriculture comes out incredibly strongly. Diversification, hard work, also comes out very strongly. Something that nobody talks about much, but you know, life is really tough at these levels, and I mean, you have to work very, very hard. And when it comes to the chronically poor, things which really had an impact on, which meant that they stayed chronically poor, were the continual shocks, the exposure to shocks, the inability to deal with those shocks, and the social expenditure, the weddings, the christenings, the funerals, the memorial services, and so on, where people feel they have to spend money. There's a massive pressure to spend. So, you know, and this is a very difficult policy area. I know in Bangladesh, for example, there's been attempt after attempt to reduce the expenditure on dowry. And it just doesn't happen. It just keeps going up and up and up. It's a really tricky area. But something that we could talk about, perhaps. I just wanted to go on as a finishing point to this last life story. This is an older single mother. This is someone who looks as though she's probably heading for an escape out of poverty. And you'll hear a transformation when I tell you some of the bare bones of the story. She's in Tigray. She's a woman in her 50s. Twice divorced, four children, in their late teens, 20s. She's now getting remittances from a brother abroad. She's been saving local saving societies. She's got the attention of a microfinance. finance institution. She'd been able to get credit, she'd been able to repay credit. She's bought a house in town to rent. Now that's a real tipping point, buying a house in town to rent. And she says she has enough money to spend on social expenditures. She's quite a happy lady. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Is it working? I'm Hashmi, and I've been working on the graduation program for over 10 years now. First as part of CGAP, and now our entire team is within the Social Protection and Jobs Global Practice at the World Bank. Now, let me start just describing what the graduation approach is. Essentially, it's about people living in extreme poverty or the chronically poor, providing many of them, a certain cohort of them, with a time-bound, multi-dimensional set of interventions with strong coaching that leads them towards building sustainable livelihoods and social inclusion and escape extreme poverty. But also beyond that, the long-term vision is that they don't stop there. They keep on going to ultimately become part of the emerging middle class. That's the big vision. Now, graduation isn't an answer to extreme poverty, and that's why we see it firmly entrenched and firmly anchored within social protection. So, for example, a lot of the people, specifically demographic categories, the poor, the elderly, children, people with severe disabilities need cash transfers. Also, as part of what could work for extreme poor and others, including those in on the graduation trajectory, healthcare, hopefully universal healthcare, at least some access to healthcare, education, schooling, quality schooling, minimum wages, safe working conditions, social insurance, all of that becomes critical, not just for graduation, but ensuring those that fall back, there's a safety net for them. However, what the graduation approach has done is pushed people beyond an inflection point above which the probabilities of falling down, the backward sliding, is significantly reduced. And there are strong RCT evidence that points to that. Those of you who are interested, I could send you the papers. I don't want to get into that. Now, as we work on that, because I want to ultimately relate to the whole resilience context, as we've been working on graduation, anchoring it within social protection, we've been looking at meso-level constraints. Markets, for one. Markets have to be opening up. Not just the self-employment small businesses, but linking up with jobs. That's a huge big trajectory, especially for the youth. Natural resource management, and that's in terms of the climatic changes, the droughts, the disasters that people face. I'll get into that a little bit more. Health education I already mentioned, but very importantly also, accountability over local government. There's a lot of resources that local government have. At least they have a strong function in distributing all of this, in identifying the poor, providing services. So as part of the graduation approach, we're not merely pushing on the economic levers, but also the social capital, issue of empowerment, and agency of women and the poor, so that they can make administration more accountable to them. Now, in terms of the resilience, poor people, many of these countries, but a lot of people, but also significant numbers of poor people, face idiosyncratic and covariant shocks. To get to the covariant shocks to a great extent. Now, what is required both for graduation to succeed and how graduation links up with this meso-level variable has to do with a set of set of interventions. And a lot of it is from disaster management, early warning systems, designing shelters that double as schools, or schools doubling as shelters, first responders. In my own country, Bangladesh, any disaster that strikes, remember in the 60s, 70s, tens of thousands of people would die. But now, very few die. And the first responders are the community, knowing that they need to take in drinking water, food that will not perish. Day two, day three, NGOs coming in. Day four, day five, the government comes in, not merely providing humanitarian assistance, but using social protection, public works program, and others to counter that. Also, what happens during this disasters or long-term climate change problems is migration. Here, too, it's an issue of at the meso-level intervening to provide people with a simple thing like a bus fare to get to the city to migrate to look for jobs, savings, cropping and changes in cropping and adaptive livelihoods. So what crops are more, in terms of our southern area, more adaptive to increasing salinity? What other livelihoods could you do over there? And making this as part of a systems approach, what graduation does is prepares people for these and prepares people to ask for all of this. And then, of course, ultimately the link to the private sector to open up jobs and business opportunities. So what resilience for us, because we are staring at it from the household side, is a huge big constraint, is an environment where the poorest need to be working in. And what we try to do, therefore, in our big push, isn't just the economics of it, of livelihood, but preparing people to access the service, to change livelihood patterns, to know where to go, and ultimately, as I said before, to make government accountable. So.
Thank you. So I'm with ACI Roca, as I mentioned, and Kristen asked me to reflect a little bit about, from the implementer perspective, some of the takeaways that that I took from this research. And I think there's actually quite a lot of really fundamental issues and pretty pretty major takeaways for me at the implementation level from this. One of the biggest ones is definitely really just the sort of necessity of taking a systems approach and getting out of, I mean, resilience in and of itself is certainly a systems approach. At the implementer level, you know, probably a shared responsibility, I suppose, between the donors that design the projects and the implementers that implement them, but sometimes it's really hard to break out of that little value chain box that we tend to work in. But putting this from the perspective, I mean, the findings here really speak to, you know, really hard-fought gains in poverty reduction that are lost, and the need to take a much more, a much closer look at what's happening, not just at kind of the obvious interrelated systems like transport or finance, but also what's happening at the household level in terms of the diversity of income sources that are influencing how even, say, the farmer that we interact with is making investment decisions on the farm. And the sort of empowerment issues in terms of the allocation of resources. Another big one is certainly the health system. I was really struck by, and you didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about it, but in some of the other country level research, the importance of, or the significance of health shocks. Outside of the kind of, you know, the floods and the hurricanes and the political instability, the sort of day-to-day facts of life that can cause major shocks and really send someone back down on a downward spiral, getting
wouldn't necessarily call that a shock, but as a parent, I would say that it is. right, and you know, so those, you know, those are certainly not elements of our programming that we typically factor into, you know, not to kind of layer so much onto a program design, but the importance of taking a systems approach in both diagnosing in a very context-specific way the environment and the sort of underlying theory of change that a project is operating on. When you look at that from a resilience perspective, I think you're kind of shocked by the complexity and the need to consider other systems and other forces in ways that that we don't typically do, to the sort of detriment of sustaining the gains that are made. Another really obvious one is just sector selection. Both of you were speaking to the importance of, or the significance of diversified livelihoods, both off-farm jobs, but also certainly the non-farm economy, and particularly the rural non-farm economy. That's a pretty tough nut to crack, I think. But, you know, there's all, even within ag, right, there's sort of this almost exclusive focus on producers, and you sort of give lip service to the, you know, at a small scale, we involve a few, you know, input shop owners and, you know, franchise and contractor, you know, agents and things like that, transport, trade, but there's not, one of the things that I took away from this is really the need to have at a much more kind of robust level of focus on developing that off, both off-farm opportunities, even within ag, recognizing the importance of that, but also a lot more significant investment in non-farm sectors and non-farm industries. Related to that is certainly the sort of targeting issue. This notion of sort of obvious, right? The further away from the poverty line you are, the less likely it is that you would fall back. But when you really unpack that, that's a really powerful sort of point in terms of the targeting of our poverty reduction programs in and of themselves. That they're even within a, not just within a kind of market development mandate, there's a lot of sense in working with the sort of less poor or those further away from the poverty line, but even within a, squarely within a kind of poverty reduction mandate, paying more attention to those people that are just above the poverty line and helping them move further along and strategies and interventions that speak to their kind of unique needs and the opportunities that they can take advantage of. I think there's a lot there to unpack. Certainly coordination. I think there's going to be a session tomorrow about the Partnership for Resilience and Economic Growth in Northern Kenya. They mentioned that a little bit earlier in the session. We have a project there in Northern Kenya. And certainly I know that the sort of coordination, particularly with the county level governments, has been critical to seeing a lot of the sort of transformation that has taken place there. For that to be effective. I won't say more there because I think there's a session on that tomorrow. The last piece is just on the knowledge management front. Definitely sort of real implications, I think, for the types of indicators that programs build into their kind of monitoring evaluation plans and in particular their learning agendas. You know, a lot of this research and the sort of poverty dynamics research is really best placed to be done at a sort of national or a donor coordination level, just because of the scale and the time frames. But I would like to see at the implementer level a lot more ownership over sort of appropriate types of indicators and learning. Life histories, you know, to really help staff unpack some of those very, very context-specific drivers that are influencing how the trajectories that the people that they're working with are on. And that's something, personally, I'm hoping to get out of the next couple of days, is bridging some of that kind of global evidence level research methodologies and indicators with what at the implementer level we can be, is sort of a realistic thing for implementers to bite off to contribute to that discussion. Because I think on the qualitative side, there's certainly a lot in terms of adjusting our theories of change that's really critical to have that type of information.
Okay, great. So Andrew, maybe if we can take just a couple more minutes to continue a thread that Anna had there. Based on what we've learned so far, what sort of policies and programs are needed to promote the off and non-farm activities that are so critical for these skills?
Thank you. It's actually a really tough question.
I won't give you
because if you look around development history, you look out for really, you know, noteworthy cases where countries have pursued diversification out of agriculture, but within the context of an agrarian society. They're pretty far and few. I mean, the really famous one is China's town and village enterprises, which had a massive impact in terms of poverty reduction in China during the 80s. You know, before the kind of bigger investment in foreign direct investment happened and China took off, it was really the township and village enterprises that were the core of its growth, and that was mostly non-agricultural, often linked to agriculture. And the other one is the territorial development in Latin America. Desarrollo. My Spanish is terrible, which has been a kind of much more, I would say, more upmarket version, less aimed at poverty reduction, more aimed at kind of spreading the benefits of growth across different territories. I'd love if people in the audience could come up with some other examples, those are the ones that I keep citing. So it's not an easy question, and I think you can maybe split it into two sorts of interventions, indirect and direct. I think probably one of the things that comes out very strongly from much of the work on poverty dynamics that we've done over the years in different countries is that if you're close to a city, even a small town, you are likely to be able to do better in your farming, in your enterprise development, than you are if you're far away. So I think urbanization, having a dispersed pattern of urbanization, you know, don't concentrate all your infrastructure resources on building up your capital cities, really have dynamic small town development programs is really important. Having said, you know, what I've said about trigger points often being, for sustained poverty escapes, often being outside of the farm sector, developing the non-farm sector and the off-farm businesses and so on is absolutely dependent on a healthy agriculture and a healthy agricultural growth. So don't just kind of switch from one to the other. You know, the development industry is famous for switching from one thing to the other thing. You know, one moment it's neoliberalism and the next moment it's industrial strategies. I mean, you know, we need to kind of keep a perspective on things.
I think USAID's sticking with ag for a while.
They're sticking with ag for a while, that's fine, but lots of others went out of ag quite a long time ago. So, you know, as a development industry, sticking with agriculture is incredibly important, and of course with smallholder agriculture at the core of that. So I don't want you to get the wrong message from this research on that issue. And I'm delighted that USAID is sticking with it. I think people have already begun to talk about the management of shocks and idiosyncratic shocks. You were talking about health shocks and so on. We were talking about social expenditures earlier on. Shock management, you know, happens at all sorts of different levels. If people can save money, that's a, or save in the form of livestock, whatever, that's a fantastic starting point. Financial inclusion in institutional terms. I mean, the focus has always been on credit, We've done a policy guide on financial inclusion, which argues that for the poorest people, what you need is savings opportunities and you need insurance. If you can build insurance into your microfinance or to any other kind of financial flows, that's brilliant. If you can find the bigger, usually the state has, if insurance is such an underdeveloped market, particularly in low-income countries, the state has to step in and get the insurance industry going and provide quite a lot of. So these are some of the enabling things, yeah? And I don't want to make a kind of a trivial discussion. In direct terms, clearly the kind of thing that Hashemi's been talking about, combinations of grants and training and advice and support, you didn't mention it, but there's a big debate in all this world about the secret ingredient. Am I wrong?
That's the coaching, yeah. I don't think there's a debate. We are fully convinced of that. We have always pushed for that.
Okay. But often the secret ingredient is something about follow-up.
Yeah.
It's the human contact between agents of change and the people that you're working with. And this is what is also enormously expensive. But, you know, anyway, that's a secret ingredient in there. But assets, grants, advice, training, different combinations of these, and then the services which people need in order to set up whatever business it is. You know, energy, decentralized sources of energy. I mean, I think electrification.
Yeah. That's the key.
That's the key.
Yes.
Okay. I agree with you. And it's, I mean, it's less neglected now. Rural energy is less neglected now. But, you know, there are still vast swathes of many countries where there is very, very little energy, or where it's a light bulb and the energy comes on and off, it's unreliable. It's not just energy, it has to be affordable.
Yes.
You've got to construct your tariff so that poor people can afford it.
Yeah.
You've got to have energy which means something, you know, that you can actually use, not just for light bulbs. So it has to be a consistent supply. These are all massive challenges.
Yep.
And then, you know, there's the whole issue about climate change and carbon emissions and so on. So, I mean, decentralized green energy sources. Some countries barely permit those sources of energy to be developed. You know, they keep very tight control over the whole energy grid, and are not in favor of decentralized grids and so on. So I think this energy is an enormous. Another issue which comes up, maybe this is more of the enabling thing, but I think it's important. We did a guide on private sector development, kind of focusing at this level, you know, taking the private sector as being the micro enterprise, or the small employing enterprise. And one of the issues, we did some work in a couple of countries which, you know, are said to have done well, Vietnam and Cambodia, on this aspect of development. And one of the issues which kept coming out of the qualitative work that we did there was corruption. It wasn't big-scale corruption. It was the corruption of people in the local authorities, sort of planning issues, getting my water connected to my business, or getting electricity. It was all those, you know, local services, the police, and so on. So, I mean, often we see anti-corruption measures at a kind of national level, and there are commissions, and, you know, it's big stuff, and you want to catch the big fish, and so on. But actually, in terms of poverty reduction, what you need is to have a very different perspective, was the message coming out from these small entrepreneurs. I don't know if I've answered the question, but I've made it too long, probably.
Maybe a start. It's a big question.
Yeah.
But, Hashemi, if you could maybe dig in a little bit deeper on, I think it's really important to recognize that we do have these different levels of constraints and enabling conditions at the macro, meso, and micro. And I think we often get very caught up in the micro household level. So maybe you could just say a little bit more about what we need to be looking at.
The micro or the meso level?
At the macro or meso.
Okay. Well, at the meso level, as I had suggested a little bit, a lot of different factors, and things like infrastructure that he pointed to. There were studies, I think, in the 80s that showed roads and connection to rural areas had a far greater contribution to poverty reduction than did any household level intervention. That high-yielding seed variety. And I know the negative unintended consequences of that, but that too. And I give examples from Bangladesh again. Small country, 175 million people. We do three croppings a year, and we are able to feed everyone in the country. So things like that, we tend to forget as we focus too narrowly on the household, even though we work from the household side. So from the meso level, what we're seeing now happening in many countries is primary school attendance, extremely high because of the big push in the MDGs. However, quality schooling still, or the lack of it, still creates this disparity between the rich and the poor. So being able to bridge that, because our key focus should be on breaking the intergenerational transfer of poverty. One of the things, the negative things of neoliberalism and the Washington Consensus had been to get the government out of most every social services. There has to be a lot of pressure to ensure that the government does not get away from its responsibility, its constitutional responsibility, to provide certain provisions. So health services, it's like everything has to be privatized. Health provisions is an essential component of social protection that has to be there to counter one of the greatest problems with idiosyncratic shocks. That, and I mentioned another thing, yes, the poor will not still be part of national governments, but local government, and more, a lot more resources are at the level of the local government. So how do you, through household programming, create that agency, look for collective actions that ensure not only that relief distribution is fair, but also there's limited corruption, that payments or budgets for local area development are pro-poor and pro-women. So support to schools rather than to something else. That, at the meso level, is critical. And the private sector does play a role. For example, in Bangladesh, 4 million poor women now have jobs in ready-made garment sector. Now, of course, it's extremely exploitative and, global capitalism, all that, blah, blah, blah. But the fact is, these women are working. And I say this, and my BRAC colleagues get very angry, my NGO colleagues get very angry. That has had a far greater impact, not just in reducing or decreasing their poverty levels, but women having cash to be able to go to the store, and I know it sounds trivial, but being able to buy lipstick for herself, it's one of the greatest leap in empowerment that one can imagine. You know? So that is happening. It's a private sector movement. Of course, it needs to be figured out more, need to figure out what training people require to fit into some of the jobs thing. So the meso level variables and the whole resilience thing, I mentioned climate change impacts. In Ethiopia, with REST, we saw how they were using public works program, and I know a lot of countries are doing it now, but using public works program not just to create jobs. It's not from Keynes's general theory that you dig a hole and you cover it up and you're creating employment. It really is making the employment count in terms of managing water resources, building, collecting rainwater, harvesting rainwater, building underground tanks, working on setting up small local level dams, creating grazing grounds. So all that is also tied into that, to using the meso level space to open up opportunities. So one really, while for us it is the micro level household intervention, for others it may be something else. So there are multiple entry points. But if we do focus on the issue of poverty or drug development, and I don't mean just extreme poor, but all levels, and if indeed the task is, as I see the vision, hopefully in my lifetime, to see poor be part of the emerging middle class, then whatever the entry point, there's something that could be done, should be done, with government as partners in some cases, the private sector as partners, but definitely always ensuring to a greatest extent at least, or significant at least, that the poor and the powerless are leading this process.
Thank you. All right, Anna, our last question. Given this research combined with your practical experience from the field, what are your current thoughts on how we should be investing in terms of transformative capacity building? We'll end with a song.
Well, I will say our implications brief that you mentioned in the beginning, in addition to the sort of, like, when you think about transformative capacities, you used this word earlier, actually, Andrew, and I jotted it down, but really, like, it really is sort of what's going to change the game? What are game changers in this community or this, you know, part of the country? And obviously, roads, electricity, infrastructure, policies at both the local level, experience of devolution in Kenya, I think, is a really big example of something that's been a huge enabling factor in some of the gains that have happened in Kenya, which I think there is some kind of beginnings of transformation in a couple of those towns in terms of the diversity of opportunities and the transforming what that value chain and what that market system looks like for people that are living in those communities. Those are not, you know, those are, again, from the implementer level, you know, those are often kind of much, those are initiatives that happen kind of outside of the typical kind of USA project, but there's a lot of collaboration and really sort of simple communication that can happen at a very local level in building synergies between people that are doing that investment or making those plans and the kind of maybe more typical market development projects in terms of building synergies and looking for opportunities to bring those players into into the vision at the market side for those communities. I think there's a lot to be done there from an implementer side. Okay, I'll just close then. Leo did a paper a couple of years ago about resilient market systems. What makes a market system itself resilient? Not just a household, but what are some kind of indicators of resilient market systems? And I think there's a lot more to unpack there within the how, you know, when we do our sort of standard initial market analyses as a project, how we analyze those findings from a resilience lens. So I'll just close by mentioning these four kind of categories of strengthen the resiliency of a market system, meaning that the market system is better able to respond to shocks, which could be, you know, change in commodity prices at a global level, or it could be the demise of a lead firm that, you know, half of the smallholders in this area were selling to. So the four areas are the diversity, so that would be the diversity of products, the diversity of market channels, redundancy in buyers, sellers, service providers, the degree of trust in the relationships amongst the actors, and the consistency and the equity of governance in those market structures. And in terms of, I mean, most of you, you know, you've already sort of emphasized the importance of market activity in the potential to create transformation in an area, I think. And these are some, that can be a negative transformation, actually, if that market system falls apart. And I think there's a lot of examples of that out there. So those four categories, diversity, redundancy, the degree of trust in a relationship, and the consistency and the equity of the governance in that market system are four things that I think we probably need to spend a little bit more time thinking about as we design our strategies in supporting those.
Thank you. All right, so with that, I'll close. close maybe the wrap up here and say, keep an eye on poverty dynamics. They're really important. Understand that our biggest impacts to the household could be from indirect interventions at other levels in the system and not actually working with the household itself. And third, which nobody said, so I'll say it, invest in panel data. We wouldn't know any of this without the panel data. So thank you to our presenters.